Archive TV News Report.
A new anti-impotence drug just hit the market, and doctors are already having a tough time keeping up with the patient demand for Viagra.
You thought your life was ended, but now it's... I'm alive again. You feel like a macho man, you know what I mean?
Man's number one way to define himself is his ability to get an erection. It's the essence of the human male soul. If you can't get an erection, it raises the question in your head, well, what is my purpose in life?
This is what all of this is about.
This is great. This is the answer to our problem.
The first ever oral pill in the history of Earth, something that mankind has wanted for all the millennia.
We were rock stars. No other company had a drug like this.
Viagra was a second sexual revolution.
It was like putting a Minto in a bottle of Diet Coke.
Men with erections visible through their trousers cross their legs one after the other. Keeping it up, the story of Viagra. Esther Ranson presents a TV show with a panel of guests and a studio audience.
Today we're going to talk about impotence.
I have been impotent all of my adult life.
Well, it certainly makes me feel as if I've lost my sort of manliness, the essential maleness.
Impotence, the failure to get an erection rigid enough for penetration. It isn't just blood flow that causes an erection. It's a mix of brain messages, nerve impulses, hormones, and muscle as well.
When it comes to the history of impotence, you've got to understand the gravity of this particular thing when it comes to us as a species, especially men and masculinity. I'm Dr. Kate Lister. I am a lecturer at Leeds Trinity University, and I study the history of sex and sexuality. So I know a lot about historical penises. This obsession has carried through for five millennia. Like, as soon as people started drawing on cave walls, what were they drawing? Massive erect penises. Huge ones that could club a woolly mammoth to death. Or ancient Peru, they're sculpting huge dicks. You could see them in Egyptian papyruses. The Romans, the Greeks, every civilization has had this obsession with this huge, big, hard penis, because it's associated with fertility, it's how you make babies, but more than that, this is what it means to be a man.
A lot of men who I talk to about impotence or their potency link it very strongly to how they perceive themselves and their self-worth. They see it as a failing in their masculinity, as a letdown in their manhood.
1992, location Britain, Merthyr Tydfil on a map.
Here is a town that used to be a thriving industrial centre, not just of Britain, but of the whole world. It's Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales.
The Independent Forecasting Group predicts that 352,000 jobs will be lost in the economy this year.
Late 80s and 90s was hard. Hard times, very hard times. But you try and get whatever money you could get. The factory I worked in, it was a steel factory, very heavy equipment. You had to be pretty fit to do the job. I think I was there about 8 years. They laid me off, so I had quite a few jobs in my time. If I was short of money, I used to go down this place called Stimbeck.
The drug was in development for angina. Pfizer didn't do a lot of in-house studies in those days. Most of the studies were contracted out to a research house in Merthyr Tydfil in Wales. And they recruited volunteers from the local population.
I went down and I said, I got a week off from work. I said, is there any studies I could do? Yes, Mr. Price, they said, we got a course. I said, what do I entail? Well, he said, you take a tablet.
Men walk along a passage.
They call us guinea pigs then, because you were testing this drug, which had never been tested before. The fear was, if I was ill and I was seriously ill, you know, that's the part that frightened me.
Volunteers were paid roughly £250 for taking part in the study. Now, remember, this was
early 1990s. We've had high inflation. They needed the money. That's why they volunteered.
How important was that money to your family?
Very important. Could we had nothing them days? Nothing. Honest God. Obviously, you get extra food in after that money. We had a coal fire then, so the coal man, instead of having 2 bags of coal, you'd have 5 bags of coal. You know, things like that. That's the money you used to come handy for, you know. We weren't actually told nothing about the drug. The documents say the tablet is for angina. You will have side effects, or you might not.
When chemists make compounds, they make hundreds of thousands of compounds over the passage of time. And we can't name everything, so they're given numbers. So UK 92480, 92480. And what that means, UK means it was synthesised by chemists in Sandwich, the lab here in the UK. And the number 92480 means it was the 92,480th compound that the chemists at Pfizer had made.
Healthy volunteers were given UK 92480 three times a day for 10 consecutive days. This was because the compound had a fairly short half-life, around about 4 hours, the time it lasts in the body.
A lot of the boys were nervous, weary, what's going to happen?
There's always a questionnaire to fill in at the end of the study, and then anything else you want to report.
Anything you want to tell me, how are you feeling? The volunteers started coming forward and saying, well, it's a little embarrassing, but I've noticed I'm getting more erections than usual. And the erections are a lot harder than usual.
We couldn't leave the building, you couldn't go out anywhere. And towards the night time, you can relax then, and we just had a good laugh.
The volunteers on the study, they talked to one another. They're all young men, and I think it became a topic of conversation amongst them. And gradually more and more of them started reporting this erection side effect.
And that's when the light bulb went on, hey, we've got something here.
There then arose the question, OK, these healthy volunteers don't have erectile dysfunction, but this drug is causing erections. If you have erectile dysfunction, will the drug cause erections? Big question.
I found it was a dawdle. It was easy money.
What did you think when you found out that you'd trialled Viagra?
I thought it was amazing, because it's a big thing now. Viagra is a very big thing. I was part of that study, and I'm glad it was found out in Merthyr Tydfil. You know what I mean?
Volunteer Idris Price. In Kent, England, Dr. David Brown, co-inventor of Viagra, drives along.
After that chance observation in Merthyr Tydfil, I immediately went to the head of clinical research at Pfizer and said, can I have some money to do an impotence study? No, he said. Nobody wants this drug. You know, I can't spend any more money on it. My budget's overspent for the year anyway.
Part of the issue with the drug development is cost. You're spending over $1 billion to get that one compound through from start to finish. So it's a very expensive business.
And I kind of stood up, closed his office door, and said, I'm not leaving this room till you give me the money.
It was a tooth and nail battle, because there wasn't a lot of confidence that it was actually going to work.
Pfizer was a pretty tough environment to work in. Drug discovery is mostly failure. He listened to the results. It took about an hour, but after an hour, he said, OK, you can have the money.
Dr. Pete Ellis, Discovery and Development, Pfizer.
I've known David Brown since when he joined Pfizer, basically. Really dedicated to the task, tenacious without a doubt. So it was David's enthusiasm, if you will, to go and fight the cause, which really set us on the road. He got us the money.
Black and white film of a research lab.
If you ever need to know how important an erection is to man, just look at some of the treatments that have been used historically to try and deal with impotence.
A lump of radium.
When radium was discovered in 1898, it instantly became the go-to cure for everything, including what was going on or not going on inside of your trousers. And there was also a gadget known as the radi-endocrinator, which was kind of like a metal pouch that you put your family jewels in, along with some radium, and it would expose them to the apparent health-giving properties of this hideous situation. Incidentally, the inventor died of bladder cancer.
One of the nastiest ones that I can think of was in the 1920s. One Russian-French surgeon called Serge Voronov decided that a really good way to do this would be to graft monkey testicles into human living subjects. And this theory was that by having part of a testicle of a monkey grafted into your body, it would boost your levels of testosterone and give you back your potency and your manly vigour.
Inventor of monkey gland treatment exhibits specimens.
He had so many people that wanted this treatment that he had to look into buying an island just to keep the monkeys on. By the time we get into the 20th century, we are using things like penis pumps.
It's so simple to use, basically. Right. Within about two pumps, you've got the seal.
Right.
And within three or four more pumps, you may well have the erection.
And once you've got the erection and it's lifted off the side, right, you just roll this down,
just
do you?
Just roll this at the ring onto the base of the penis.
Right.
That shouldn't have happened. And you're ready to go.
There were pumps that were surgically put inside the penis.
The head of the penis still on there, and you could bend it down for concealment and then bend the penis up for penetration, and a pair of these would be put in to the shaft of the penis.
It's fascinating, frequently horrifying, and constantly revealing that throughout history, people have gone to great lengths to try and give themselves great, hard, turgid lengths.
Alvarado Medical Plaza in San Diego.
In sexual medicine, we're 1 inch above sleaze, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. My name is Erwin Goldstein, and I do sexual medicine, and I love sexual medicine. It is the most fascinating, the most exciting, most innovative form of medicine. The penis is a penetration tool when erected. How does that happen? I mean, it's a miracle, to be quite honest. I mean, it's not a bone. A bone is forever rigid, but you don't want a forever rigid state, you want a flaccid state. So, pretty fascinating world. That was relatively poorly described and scientifically appreciated.
Sex historian Dr. Kate Lister.
For most of human history, we have thought that impotence was caused by, that it was psychological, that it wasn't physical, it didn't have a physical cause. And this was turned upside down and on its head in 1983. At a urology conference in Las Vegas by Professor Giles Brinley.
What do you remember about Vegas? Oh,
not much. Much like any other American city.
Las Vegas, 1983. A giant neon cowgirl sign, then the lights of the main strip after dark. Inside a casino, smartly dressed customers are served drinks at a bar, while other patrons sit at lines of slot machines, playing for money.
Now, in those early days, you took your wives to things like the American Urology Association meeting. It was very, very proper, if you will.
Just picture the scene is that everybody's dressed to the nines, they're about to go out for dinner, it's the closing talk of the conference, and in walks Professor Brinley in a tracksuit. So already everybody's, this is a bit strange.
I was one of the speakers. He was the highlighted keynote speaker. And we both went together to put our slides in before the meeting. I remember a man in a sort of a jogging outfit while I was in my suit and tie, kind of weird. And we both went to the men's room together. He went into a stall, I just went into the urinal area.
I give many lectures, I go to many scientific conferences, or used to go to many scientific conferences, scientific and medical. And this was not very different from others.
Giles Brinley stood up and gave his presentation supporting the injection of vasodilator drugs into the penis. And towards the end of his presentation, he said, and here's one I prepared earlier. stepped out from behind the podium with his trousers round his knees.
He pulled his pants down and said, I have an erection because I injected a drug in my penis. And it was very startling and very awkward and very amazing. You have to just imagine the scene.
I discovered that if you inject a smooth muscle relaxant into the penis, you get an erection. The erection lasts inconveniently long, lasts many days. When people were a bit surprised or something or other, anyway, they said, oh, well, I'll show you. And I showed that I had an erection.
He whipped it out. There can be no other way of putting it. That's exactly what he did. And it's recorded as being a long, thin erection.
Dr. Brindley then left the podium and went to the audience so that people could touch his penis so they would realize it wasn't one of those penile prosthesis implants, that it really was his penis.
It created a huge shift in the field of urology because now the search was on for a cure. What Brindley did, it was bonkers, but it was instrumental and a game changer because his actions that day sparked the hunt for a cure.
And in this moment, in this bizarre setting of a Vegas fancy hotel, we resolved the physiology of erection in 1 hour.
I'd shown that I had an erection. You didn't need to know exactly how good an erection it was, but it was pretty good. It was pretty stiff and large.
So what Giles Brindley's work did is it proved that erections have a physical cause, and people remembered it because if there's a physical cause, there's a physical cure. Giles Brindley, as mad as he was an erection pioneer.
A penis-shaped kite with a red tip flies in a cloudy sky. Bristol, England, 1993. Pete Ellis.
It's important to take the drug forward to proof of concept. Question, would the drug work in a patient with erectile dysfunction? So to do that, we consulted with Dr. Clive Gingell.
The Bristol Clinic was absolutely critical in this. Clive Gingell had a group there.
A doctor kneels to examine a man's erection.
He got a phenomenal result. 12 of those 16 patients were reporting fabulous erections.
Men with erections visible through their trousers cross their legs.
The drug was doing something to enhance erections in these particular men in this trial.
Pfizer World Headquarters, New York. Head of Marketing for Pfizer USA, Rooney Nelson.
We've got a situation where these wonderful folks in England had now come to us and said, listen, we were doing this trials. They all got erections. Really? Okay. And we think that that's a win. Is that correct? At that point, if you know anything about pharmaceutical marketing, you know, there's no guarantee this product's ever going to make it to market. Still early days. You're still waiting on very basic clinical data. There was something about Viagra that could either be extremely special or disastrous.
But the question was, would the company allow us to continue the program? And would it work for a wider spectrum of men? Because we'd excluded men with diabetes, men with heart conditions. So how effective is it going to be in those kind of men?
Small boats moored on a marina overlooked by hills. Swansea, Wales, 1994. Pfizer ordered trials in men with diabetes. Dr. David Price of the Viagra Diabetic Trials.
When Pfizer got this drug, UK92480, which became Viagra, they wanted to do some trials, and one of their medical officers called me to discuss this trial, which involved showing men erotic videos. Pfizer had stipulated it had to be heterosexual men in a stable relationship. And they were all regular guys, all married. And they were just ordinary blue-collar Swansea men. The man is lying in bed with a device called a rigid scanner, which is two strain gauges effectively, one in the base, one around the tip of the penis, attached to this device, whilst watching dirty videos. Pfizer supplied all of the equipment and the videos. And the videos were awful. I didn't find them the slightest bit stimulating. So I phoned up Pfizer and they said, well, go out and buy some more and we'll pay you for them. Back in those days, they were illegal and difficult to get hold of, and I didn't want to buy them in Swansea because in case someone saw me coming out of the sex shop in Swansea, so I went to Newport.
Inside an adult store, videos on shelves.
The sex shop I went to, it was like the archetypal sleazy man you'd expect to be in a sex shop. He said, "What are you interested in?" And he was suggesting every kind of activity, perversion you wanted. You know, he seemed to, you know, he wanted to know what I was into. And we also needed some magazines. And I wasn't going to buy some dirty magazines, so my wife thought I was being a big wuss, but, you know, for not wanting to go into a sex shop in Swansea, and she was quite happy to go and buy dirty magazines.
A woman gets into a car and hands a man a bundle of adult magazines.
I made it quite clear to the men that they would not be interrupted. No one would enter the room, and when I did come in, I would knock before I entered. And there was a box of tissues for them as well.
Viagra only works when men are sexually stimulated. It's a bit like filling a bath. You can imagine sexual stimulation is like turning the tap on, but the bath is not going to fill unless you put the plug in. And for these men with erectile dysfunction, Viagra was a bit like putting the plug in.
It was very rewarding to treat these men. You saw how you transformed their lives. Even more rewarding when you saw them with their wives. Their delight and improvement in their self-respect was clearly evident.
So really, this was a point where we knew for certain that unless something unexpected happened, we should have a drug for erectile dysfunction. And I think that was really probably one of the high points of the whole process for me.
It's Dr. Ian Astolo. The smallest, most unassuming person you would ever find, right? Pure, unadulterated genius. So Ian, in many respects, is considered the true father of Viagra. Do you have any idea how many babies may have been created by Viagra? It's not a precise science, but there's an estimate that there's somewhere between 5 to 9 million babies that are a direct result of Viagra. So Ian, I call him the world's biggest baby daddy. Because I'm like, Ian, you know, you got like 5 to 8 million kids, dude. How you pay for all of that?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't call myself Dr. Viagra. I've been very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. Obviously, I have made a contribution, but so have lots of others.
I went into my office one day, and there was a letter on my desk from one of the patients saying, "Look, I didn't give the tablets back. I know I promised I would, but you've got to realise this is the first time in 25 years my wife and I have had a sex life." I mean, it really hit you at that point, just how important this was going to be to a lot of people.
Several refused to return their unused tablets. On one occasion, one of the first men we had back for tablet counting, and the Pfizer gave a lot of tablets, so a lot of unused tablets to return. He put that and we counted them, and he suddenly realised that he wasn't getting his tablets back, and he said, "Oh, no, you don't." And he went round with his arm and he swept the tablets off the table. I don't think he had a container. I think he put them in his pocket, as I recall.
This is, I think, where the stars lined up in the right way. We'd almost come across the perfect mechanism, as it were, or perfect kind of drug to treat this condition.
Scantily clad pole dancers.
We are the lads.
The late 90s and the early noughties, I remember as being leery and leery and brash and trashy and in your face and all about lads and ladettes. And there was a lot of talk about sex. Sex was on TV in Sex and the City. It was on Ally McBeal, it was on Eurotrash, which I was obsessed with.
Now, we've always been raunchy. We've always been an absolute group of mucky pups. But the 90s saw that go mainstream. If you think about something like Baywatch, all those beautiful people just running around in outfits that barely cover their bodies, that was on, like, primetime TV.
Bill Clinton hugs Monica Lewinsky.
We had Bill Clinton with his famous Monica Lewinsky affair.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
You had the Spice Girls and talk about girl power. But a lot of the messages I was getting in women's mags then were still how to give the perfect blowjob.
And don't forget, of course, we've got the birth of internet pornography. And Viagra was launched into that. It was like putting a Minto in a bottle of Diet Coke. It just...
Black and white film of Pfizer's early premises.
Pfizer's been around for over 100 years. Pfizer is one of the first companies to put penicillin on the battlefields in World War II.
The Navy operated an evacuation hospital, which began functioning on the island on the ninth day of the battle.
That's how Pfizer made their name. And it's a conservative company. And here we are about to go and talk about erections.
You're working at Pfizer, and you have now invented Viagra. Oh, it's amazing. You have this wonder drug. And you'd be forgiven for thinking that you could just launch that on the world and it would be an instant success. But that wasn't the process of trying to take it to market, because despite the fact that the 90s were characterised by a very kind of permissive sexuality and this raunch culture, not by everybody. How the hell are you going to market a sex drug to them?
Here's Jennifer Dobler.
My name is Jennifer Dobler, and I was on the Viagra team in charge of the consumer marketing. I don't remember the exact moment when I first heard about it, but I think it would have been like, wow, okay, we're doing that. That's what we're going to be doing. That's a surprise, right? Pharmaceutical companies operated kind of under the radar. The companies like Pfizer were sort of quietly in the background. So we were going to be kind of coming out from the shadows, if you will. You know, you go into Pfizer and there it is on East 42nd Street, you know, which is out of all the old 1950s movies, you know, that you grew up watching on, you know, television in the afternoons or whatever. And it was fun and kind of quirky, but at the same time, it was fairly conservative.
Where men and women, representing a variety of talents, join their efforts and materialize their dreams.
It was just that classic New York, seen it in a million movies. It said Pfizer World Headquarters, right? And it's this big building sitting on the corner, and you'd go in, and it just had this really funny retro feeling. There was a coffee cart person who would come at 10 in the morning, and they'd ring a bell, and everybody, like Pavlovian, we'd be like, oh, I think I need a cup of coffee. And we'd go and get coffee or a snack. It was a world unto itself, really.
This is probably the hardest marketing challenge ever in the pharmaceutical industry, and maybe one of the hardest marketing challenges ever in business. You don't build a reputation as a top marketer at a company like Pfizer, especially if you're a black male, unless you're really, really, really good. And I was not confused that as a male, and especially as a black male, I had to be really, really good to even have a seat at the table. I think I had proven over the previous couple of years that I knew what I was doing, I was very good at it, and arguably one of the best in the industry. Pfizer certainly had no problems with anyone, but they weren't advocating for people either. It was, you come in, sink or swim. And if you get it wrong, you ruin the company's reputation, you ruin your own reputation, and there's no coming back from that. I'm not so sure that my wife in particular didn't think I was about to be the sacrificial lamb. She's sitting there going, yeah, I don't know. They're putting you on a what drug? To do what? Yeah, okay. I think if this doesn't go well, you're gonna be Marie Antoinette. You're gonna be guillotined. I was like, okay, thanks, honey. I appreciate that.
Two really strong ideas were coming through from the research. One, how deeply impotence impacts a person's sense of self.
It's going to make dating difficult. It's going to make confidence difficult. It breaks men.
The other real key message was just how much this impacted relationships.
Dougie felt devastated, but he was unable to share these fears, so he kept it all inside.
For how long? Because you know
for years he kept this inside.
I remember just, you know, being a relatively young person at the time, just being how deeply touched by how poignant what these men were saying about how much it hurt their relationships and how much that mattered to them.
You hold back a lot. And from holding back, you get frustrated, and frustrated leads to other arguments about things that have nothing to do with sex in that sense.
Most often, the man who's got it, he thinks he may be the only man in the world who's got it, doesn't talk to his partner, but starts avoiding situations where sex might be expected.
How does it affect you?
Immensely. It's put a lot of strain on our marriage, on our relationship. The cuddles have gone, the tenderness has gone. He feels extremely guilty because I've still got the feelings, whereas he hasn't. When it first happened, I did think it was my fault.
Couples were living in this sort of tacit agreement, this detente, if you will, that we're not going to go there because I know you can't go there, honey, right? And I'm afraid to go there because I don't want to disappoint you and I don't want to embarrass you. So in their way of caring for each other sometimes, it was this way that they just gave it up and didn't talk about it.
It's not a joke. And if you're in this position, it's absolutely devastating because our marriage has been nothing like what it should have been, and a very important part has been taken away.
And so almost the entire arc of intimacy, from the very, you know, conclusion, some people would say, of intimacy, which is the sex act, all the way back to just kissing or touching or hugging, everything had gone away. And that's a tremendous loss in a relationship.
1996, 18 months to launch in the USA. Gliding over city streets, a yellow taxi driving along, then a silver-haired man sitting in a diner.
I'm Dr. Sal Giorgiani. While I was at Pfizer, I was director of external affairs. A lot of folks see Viagra, and they have this opinion, well, that's a drug that's just going to sell itself. But there was a lot of things going on behind the blue curtain.
When you're playing at a high level and you're playing high-level chess, you can't play it alone, right? You need really good pieces. And without question, we had some of the most brilliant minds in the industry on the team.
Rooney and I were on the road a lot together. And at some point, we were sort of viewed as the twins.
Only their mother can tell them apart.
I don't know if you ever saw the movie from some time ago with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. It was called Twins. Now, if you know anything, they look nothing alike.
Now, Rooney, as you saw, is a dark-skinned Jamaican fellow, and I'm a pretty fair-complexioned Italian guy.
But together, we had the responsibility of sort of getting in front of a lot of the potential challenges with the brand and keep the brand going.
So, yeah, the landscape was filled with booby traps, and I was sort of the guy with a minesweeper going out there looking for what the concerns and the booby traps were. Rooney is a dynamic, dyed-in-the-wool marketer. He understood the market dynamics. He understood who the key players were. And he wasn't shy, if you will, about getting time with important key opinion leaders.
We had to get this thing right, because the rewards for getting it right might be good, but the punishment for getting it wrong was going to be absolutely horrible. Talk about definitely not getting an erection if you get it wrong, right? You might get castrated. So we had actually talked to a few people, Art Kaplan, for example. Help us think through how we can get the message out correctly.
Connecticut.
So I'm Art Kaplan, and I have worked for about 50 years in the field of medical ethics. Well, I was minding my own business in my office one day, and I got a phone call. And the person on the other end said, I'm calling you from Pfizer. This gentleman on the phone said, look, I have a very interesting dilemma for you.
We knew that we faced several potential threats, and we knew we were wading into that marketplace.
When I show up in the Pfizer offices, I had to really start doing catastrophic thinking. What could really go south? There's even talk at the company, maybe we don't pursue this drug because it might ruin our reputation and we're not going to sink the company based upon a backlash against us because we have this pill.
How do we make it okay to talk about erections in a very pluralistic society that is very judgmental, especially when it comes to sex and anything sex-related?
Religious groups might object and say, what are you selling a sex pill for? That's going to lead to people having sex more outside marriage. What if somebody rapes somebody on this drug? What was the company's defense? What were we gonna do if someone's kids got a hold of the drug and had a Viagra party? What were we gonna say if somebody took the pill, had sex, and died? So it's pretty serious discussion.
Let's whiteboard every potential negative scenario we could see, and let's make sure that we have a plan in place proactively to address each of these things.
We have to remember that mainstream culture, especially in America, is still deeply religious. It's still to the right. It's very conservative. How are we going to deal with this? And some genius came up with the idea that we need religious approval.
St. Peter's Basilica, Vatican City.
Our colleague in Italy went over to the Vatican. I'm not even quite sure how she got a meeting with the Vatican. It's not something you normally would expect a pharmaceutical company representative doing, to talk about erectile dysfunction. It's kind of an interesting scenario. It was kind of like getting the blessing of the Pope.
Strange as it may seem, they had a medication that was going to cement marriages, slow down divorces, and, if you will, be good for the values that the Catholic Church and the Pope wanted to promote. You never saw discussions about, what does this mean for the gay community? What does this mean for a single guy who's thinking about his sex life? What does it mean in nursing homes where people might want to have sex, but they're not married? None of that.
It wasn't for fun sex. It was for husband and wife and making baby sex. It was central to a good marriage, which is really clever of Pfizer to do that, because this isn't about having a naughty time. It's about saving the institution of marriage. And the Pope says it's okay as well.
San Diego.
The average duration of sex in the United States is 7.3 minutes. You have it 4 times a month. 7 minutes, 4 times a month is 30 minutes. Now take how many minutes there are in a month and what percentage sexual intercourse is happening in the duration of someone's life. It's a fraction of someone's existence. Why does it have such importance? We spend much of our day preparing for something that's 7.3 minutes. You get dressed, you put on perfume, you go to a restaurant, and it all boils down to 7.3 minutes. But boy, oh boy, those are very important minutes.
Bed springs bounce, a train goes through a tunnel, and fireworks explode.
For something that affects only a small part of your life, having this dysfunction is just devastating.
The word for erectile dysfunction was always impotence. And the NIH decided that it was a pejorative term. It means lack of power. And they should make it a new name. And they put together a group of people, and Erwin was one of the people on that team, and they came up with the name erectile dysfunction. And this is a poster from that original meeting. And I'm really proud of that, because it's probably one of the pieces of where my husband made a difference in this world for sexual health.
A strong man flexes his muscles.
If you want to sell them something to cure the impotence, you have to get them to admit that they're impotent. And that is really, really difficult. Nobody wants to be impotent.
The linguistic evolution from the term impotence to erectile dysfunction, I think, operates on a twofold level. They make the whole topic seem a lot more accessible and a lot less intimidating and less like something that it is stigmatizing and shameful to talk about.
That's very clever. That's very clever, because now it's not a lack of power, now it's a dysfunction. And if it's a dysfunction, it can be fixed. It's a blip. It's something that can be treated.
If you make a comparison with a car, you're saying the problems here are mechanical. They're under the hood. It's about your penis and your pipes. Whereas using a term like impotence suggests that it's more about the driver or the style of driving. It's much less shamey and much less blamey.
Erectile dysfunction is something that's happening to you. It's not your fault. Go to the doctor, get it treated. It's a masterstroke. It's a brilliant piece of marketing.
But this linguistic move hasn't been entirely altruistic. It's not just about making things easier for people. It's also about making things easier for people to buy.
Boston.
There was this study called the Massachusetts Male Aging Study. A team of researchers started viewing impotence through an entirely different lens. In the past, if you were impotent, it was very absolute. You absolutely could not get it up. This team of researchers instead asked people questions about not just can you get hard, but how satisfying is your sex life?
That ended up being my job. So there are machines that record erections.
But there are strategies that you could just ask patients, okay? Do you have an erection that's rigid enough for penetration, i.e. when you push down on it, doesn't buckle? Do you have an erection that is reasonable for intercourse, but it isn't fully rigid? Do you have an erection that is close to being adequate for erection, but isn't good enough? Or do you have something that is neither close and not adequate for erection? No ED, mild, moderate, severe ED. And that's how Pfizer got this across the finish line. And then when you put that together, I'll never forget this one, 52% of men aged 40 to 70 were found to have a mild, moderate, and severe form of ED, 52%. So it was actually more common in a 40 to 70-year-old man to have an erection problem than to have a normal erectile function.
By opening up this spectrum, we are also opening up the number of people, the breadth of audience of men who perceive themselves now to have issues, and perhaps issues that they're going to be marketed medical solutions to.
A man in his 70s is typing on a computer.
So my name is Robert Whitaker, and I've been working as a journalist, doing investigative journalism for a number of decades, actually. Then I co-founded a company called CenterWatch, which looked at the business of clinical trials and how actually it was changing due to financial influences. So now let's turn to Viagra and why we became interested in it. We got interested in it because it was a story of how markets are expanded, or diagnostic categories are expanded in order to prepare a drug for more success in the marketplace. And so what we found very quickly was there really wasn't that big of a market for people who were, quote, impotent. But if you could change the definition, think about how much you can expand your market. And that's what happens as this time as Viagra's coming to market. And how did they do this? Well, there was the Massachusetts Male Aging Study, which all of a sudden said, you can still get an erection every day and you can usually perform fine. But if you're not satisfied with this, completely satisfied, you have erectile dysfunction. So all of a sudden they switched the characterization of who could have erectile dysfunction to someone who was performing quite well, was getting an erection, had sexual intercourse on a regular basis, but just said, I'm not completely satisfied with my erection. Now, the minute they do that, they're expanding the market dramatically.
I think that's offensive, to be quite honest. These are people who have an awful condition that affects their performance, their self-worth, their self-esteem, and they're seeking help to improve their life quality.
You take a drug approved for a small group of people, now you expand it to a lot of people, but the message that goes out to the public is, oh, maybe 50% of all men are having this sort of dissatisfaction. This was such a visible example of how you can build markets for a drug. So they knew right away, this isn't going to be just for impotency. This is going to become a lifestyle drug, and they celebrated, they championed that.
Shares of Pfizer hit another all-time high today, like a gold mine, and Pfizer hasn't even begun to market it.
People poured into Pfizer stock. Pfizer stock, I think, rose like almost doubled as Viagra was coming to market.
From traders crowding the floor of a stock exchange to city lights after dark, March 1998.
There could be a major improvement available soon in the medical treatment of impotence. Federal health officials are poised to vote on whether to approve the first potential cure in a pill.
When a drug is submitted for registration with the Food and Drug Administration in the US, Pfizer were actually a little bit concerned. People were reporting headaches if they took too much, coloration with the eyes. They were mild, frankly, compared with the big benefit of the drug, but there was always the risk that the FDA are going to say, yeah, but this disease doesn't matter very much. So there was that little bit of nervousness.
So we've done all this work. We've spent countless time, got enormous amounts of money. So it's a very high-stakes business, where the outcome is never really guaranteed.
And the amount of data that was filed to the regulatory authority at the end of that would have filled the size of this room.
So we had been told that we were on a 6-month review for Viagra. Month 5 comes, and now you go, we're down to the last 30 days within which we're either gonna get approved or we're gonna get it rejected. And it's like, still, nothing but crickets from the FDA. And you can't call them, you can't ask what's going on, that's not an option. You just gotta sit there and wait.
27th of March, 1998.
So now we're at the end, the last possible day. It's a Saturday. So the core team, it's about 10 of us. We all trudge in from our respective homes and we get in a room. It's about 8 in the morning because we all know this is the day. This is before emails and all those things at that point. We're sitting there and it's a fax machine. The tension is now thick enough to cut with a knife. Personally, I'm thinking my future is on the line, right? And about 10 minutes later, the fax kicks in. Yes! That screeching noise that everyone used to know from fax machines. And our lawyer runs over to the fax machine and everybody sits down. It's just Judy over there. And papers start to come out. She lifts it up. She looks down and she looks up and says, we got approved. I remember I jumped on the phone and went, fuck me! We're fucking gonna actually do this thing.
It was an eagerly awaited move. Today, the FDA approved Viagra. It's the first pill to treat impotence.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senior Vice President Sales, U.S. Pharmaceuticals, Hank McCrory.
Good morning, Pfizer. Welcome to May 4, 1998. Because of Viagra, it's a date you'll never forget.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce Marketing Director Rooney Nelson.
Good morning. We have reached a point in the Viagra launch program where it all comes together. This is the beginning of a lot of beautiful relationships between you and Viagra, between Viagra and your doctors, and a particularly personal and special relationship between Viagra and the millions of ED patients who have been waiting for this moment to arrive.
We get to Orlando. We have a situation where all the sales teams, 5,000 people, they have quotas. This is their targets, their forecast in terms of sales. And every one of those 5,000 reps has already exceeded quota based on pre-orders for Viagra. Unheard of. Before they had gone and talked to one prescriber about the product, we already had a backfill of prescriptions that got every single rep in the country already over their quota for the year. And I said, well, that's how we're going to start this meeting.
Good morning.
Welcome, guys. Good news. You're all already in the bonus package because you've all already sold more Viagra than we had you forecast to do over the next 12 months. So I think it's fair to say people were pretty excited.
Crowds of excited-looking attendees dancing after the Pfizer Orlando launch. On a sunny day, a blue car speeds along a U.S. highway.
I'm Jamie Reedy. I was one of the original Viagra salespeople. So I'm sitting in a Pontiac Grand Prix, and I just can't believe it. It's been, you know, 20 years since I was in this car, and considering how much time I spent behind the windshield, I'm getting sort of overwhelmed with nostalgia. Like, it's hard to imagine how much time I spent in a car like this. In pharmaceutical sales, your car is your office, and your trunk is your storage locker, basically. You fill it with everything at the start of the day. So in here, I would have the samples for my three or four different drugs, boxes full of pens with the drug names on them, and you say to a doctor, and I remember Dr. Smith, this pen only writes Viagra. When you launch a drug, the general feeling is supposed to be, our drug's the best, but for Viagra, we knew we were the best because no other company had a drug like this. The only two competitors were a needle injection into the penis. Not a lot of guys running to the physician's office for that. And then another drug, which was basically a straw stuck down the urethra and then a pellet, like a Pez dispenser, dropped down there. Again, not super popular with the patients. Stop
it! A black and white film clip of a man screaming.
So if I were to ask you, what do you think our marketing message was? Do we want to really talk about and go out with a campaign that's all about harder penises, erect penises? I don't think so. And I remember putting my feet up on the table and going, F me, I think I got this. I just figured this out. We're going to make billions of dollars. It's the most genius marketing idea ever. It's a pill.
There has never been a product like Viagra. Not ever. It's simple. It's a pill. It doesn't get any better than that.
People associate pills with quick, easy, not a big deal. We want to take something that's not quick, not easy, a huge deal to almost every man in the world, and make it simple. It's a pill. Try Viagra. It's a pill. And I think it's proven to be one of the most certainly time-tested, genius marketing strategies, or else we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation.
In a commercial, a man kicks the diamond-shaped blue pill as if scoring a goal.
The name Viagra as a brand is second only to Coca-Cola in how universally recognized and known it is. It's an incredibly successful name.
Viagra.
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 When I think of the word Viagra, I think of abracadabra, like a magic spell for dongs. Shazam, Viagra, and your magic wand is now magical once again.
So one of the things that comes up all the time is, how did Viagra get the name? The way it works in the pharmaceutical industry is there's a name bank, because everything has to really go through a series of legal and regulatory checks. Viagra, does that mean anything in Russian? Does it mean something in Spanish? Is it a potential challenge in Cantonese? So you just have a name bank. That's the process. And after we took those brands through, there was really only one winner, and it was Viagra. But it's not the sexiest story ever.
It's completely made up, but when you think about it, it's such a clever word to use because it sounds slightly like vigor. You've got the Viagra vigor. It's a hard sound as well. Like, it wouldn't have worked if it was called something like Floopy Bloopy, or like that just wouldn't have sold anything.
Even the color blue, Viagra was colored blue with the idea that it gave an impression of calm, of cool, confident masculinity. And that diamond shape. When you think diamonds, you think the hardest substance on God's blue and green earth, right? Makes sense.
We wanted to make it unique. The Viagra pill was the first pill that carried the Pfizer name on the pill. Everything was designed so that every time you took the pill, there would be either direct or subliminal reference to Pfizer as a company.
A vintage black and white commercial shows a spinning package. Two slogans appear. It's coming. It's on the way. 15th of April, 1998. Viagra goes on sale in the USA.
A new anti-impotence drug just hit the market, and doctors are already having a tough time keeping up with the patient demand for Viagra.
The hottest new item at the drugstore, Viagra.
As soon as the news came out, we were getting inquiries about it.
The number of patients that want Viagra is extraordinary.
You thought your life was ended, but now it's... I'll sing a song. I'm alive again. I tell you, you feel like a macho man, you know what I mean?
Sounded wonderful. Sounded like something we definitely should try. It sounded too easy, actually. When he tried it and it worked, we were thrilled.
When Viagra launched in the States, some men were so desperate to get this enchanted gravy for their meat and two veg, they wanted to be at the front of that dinner queue, that they lied to their doctors. they said that they had terrible kidney pain or that they were urinating blood in order to jump the queues and get there before everybody else.
I've been a pharmacist for 45 years.
And ever seen anything like this?
I've never seen anything like this in my life.
In Atlanta, Dr. John Stripling wore out his surgery hand writing prescriptions and now rubber stamps his orders.
What is the real market here? And Pfizer came back with somewhere between $1 billion and $11 billion. Quite a wide range, because we weren't sure how many patients would actually come forward and use the drug.
The National Institutes of Health estimates that more than 30 million American men, the majority of men over age 40, experience some degree of impotence. Yet only 5 to 10% of them seek treatment.
We knew the patients were out there. If every single one of them took our drug, it could be $11 billion a year. So it was a huge sum of money. How do you actually make the most out of it?
Here's Jennifer Dobler.
If you think Viagra has been highly visible over the last few months, I assure you, the dance has only just begun.
One of the biggest projects I was working on was our direct-to-consumer television advertising. So that was a tremendous boon to the product. We had this amazing opportunity to make a commercial with Senator Bob Dole, who had just 2 years prior run for president, was one of the most respected government people in our nation.
He was going to say in a TV ad that he was taking Viagra. Bob Dole, he's a respected guy, conservative, wouldn't be naturally be expected to come out and admit that he took Viagra. This is awesome.
He was the perfect person for what we needed to do, which is to really give dignity to this condition. It was taking away all the stigma and the shame of it and showing that it can affect anyone.
When I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, I was primarily concerned with ridding myself of the cancer. But secondly, I was concerned about possible post-operative side effects like erectile dysfunction, ED, often called impotence.
Yeah, I educated Bob Dole. I was one of the ones teaching him. Bob Dole came over to Sandwich. He spent a day with us in the labs. We talked to him. We made presentations to him, described the type of people who suffer from erectile dysfunction and why.
You know, it's a little embarrassing to talk about ED, but it's so important to millions of men and their partners.
And then we're thoroughly let down when the ad comes out and he refuses to say Viagra. He refuses to let Viagra be put anywhere in the ad. He really was just trying to get men to go to their doctor and get checked for erectile dysfunction.
The point I want to make is there are many treatments available for ED. So my advice is get a medical checkup.
Obviously, the number one choice for us would have been Hugh Hefner, just with his whole lifestyle, every guy in America. Wait, what? Hef? Hef's taking it? Okay, I gotta get off the couch and go get a prescription for this.
Night falls over a cityscape.
So I am traveling up almost once a week, and my wife, who knows what I'm doing, is very curious what's going on up there. And I say, it's unbelievable. They're going to make a lot of money. People are going to buy this stuff. I wish I could buy stock in this company. And my wife would say, well, can't we? And I'd say, that just doesn't seem right from an ethics point of view, putting on my medical ethics hat. And we would kind of shake our heads and say, we're going to miss this boat, but we can see that it's sailing to a very profitable island.
The stock price has hit a new high, something's happened, and now we have a drug for erections. You know, how can life get any better than that?
Cash tells.
In just a week, prescriptions for Viagra went from 500 to more than 36,000.
Everyone's talking about it. A lot of men are buying it. Pfizer says sales of Viagra the past 3 months totaled $411 million.
We were rock stars. I got a standing ovation in a urologist's office lobby. That never happened when I sold antihistamines or antibiotics. The doctor came out and he said, this is the V-man. And the guys all started clapping. One of the coolest parts was when doctors started calling me to get samples. You know, normally we are the little fish that just float around the shark's mouth, just hoping to feed on their work, right? We're annoying doctors. But in this case, the doctors were banging down our door. In the middle of 2000, one of my teammates called and said, hey man, you're number one in the country. And I almost just locked up the brakes on the highway. What the F are you talking about? He said, you have the number one territory in the country. So I started writing my memoir. I accidentally got into pharmaceutical sales, and then I ended up the number one guy in the country. And when I stop and think about it, it's amazing.
15th of September, 98, Viagra's approved for use in the UK. BBC TV presenter Robert Kilroy Silk hosts a daytime chat show.
Hello and good morning. Well, after a lot of hype, it's finally arrived in this country. This is what all the fuss is about.
Viagra, the best-known drug in the world, was invented in Britain, and now at last it's legally available here.
The whole hype was just off the scale. Then the press were turning up at my home door, banging on the door. They found out where I lived. It was just crazy.
This is great. This is the answer to our problem.
We can just go back to having a normal married life now.
I know that this drug is here because of the hard work and dedication of a lot of people, but I was one of them. This is something to be really proud of.
So Viagra launches in the UK. It finally arrives after much hype from across the pond. And it finally launches in September of 1998. And you would think that the British public would be here with open arms waiting for it. But it actually met with quite a lot of resistance.
The anti-impotence drug Viagra has been given its European licence, making it legal for sale throughout the European Union, but it won't be widely available on the NHS here, at least not for a while.
Who decides who gets to take the wonder drug Viagra, the doctors or the government? The two sides are at loggerheads tonight over how far the little blue potency pill should be rationed to save money.
If I've got to find £50 million, it's better spent on a heart condition or dealing with cancer or doing hip joint replacements than on providing for impotence.
Frank Dobson, the then health secretary, announced for the first time in the history of the NHS a drug that had been approved for use would not be prescribed on the NHS.
Rolling now.
And I was incensed at this.
And it's mainly a reflection of our Victorian attitudes to sexual dysfunction. It has been singled out. Why is sexual dysfunction being singled out? I mean, treating indigestion, treating hay fever, treating skin conditions, none of those are life-threatening.
Some of the things that Frank Dobson said reflected that, and it confirmed my view that... I'm not criticising him, but he was a person of his time, and his attitude was widespread, I'm sure.
I don't think very many people in this country think that the NHS should be subsidising, putting a bit of zip into somebody's bit on the side.
After months of pressure, Viagra is available on private prescription for £6 a pill.
If it wasn't a drug designed to give men erections, there can be little doubt that the Health Secretary's ideas about when doctors may prescribe Viagra would have passed with a little less argument.
By 2000, the NHS is spending over £17 million a year on Viagra. In the USA, the pill becomes the fastest-selling drug ever.
It is safe to say that Viagra has received more media attention around the world than any other new pharmaceutical medicine in history.
It soon became what is called a blockbuster drug. When a drug officially makes over $500 million, it's considered a blockbuster.
Police in Poland say they've uncovered what's thought to be the world's largest fake Viagra factory. Officers uncovered counterfeit Viagra worth an estimated 4 million euros.
There was probably more sales of counterfeit drugs than Pfizer made from the blue pill. It was that bad. It was the most counterfeited drug of all time. In the early 2000s, Pfizer was spending an enormous amount of money trying to find the counterfeit pills, find where they come from, stop them.
It's alleged millions of euros worth of the counterfeit drugs were sold via the internet.
There was always a problem with counterfeiting. The majority of pills that are out there worldwide are counterfeit. They're not even real stuff.
La Viagra de contrabando tiene...
And obviously people are making a lot of money selling who knows what, some sort of fairy dust as the medicine.
We knew it was going to be counterfeit before it was a billion-dollar drug because some men might not want to tell their GP or whoever else I've got this problem, but if they saw it advertised on the internet or anywhere else, they might be tempted to sort of bypass the medical
route, this would open up avenues for sort of counterfeiters to target men more easily.
An early morning wake-up call.
This is the unlicensed version of Viagra. There are several tens of thousands of pounds worth of product here.
In a commercial, a racing car with the Viagra logo speeds along a track. Then a driver, his face hidden by his helmet, walks towards the camera.
Pretty soon the marketing campaigns shifted to a much broader audience. You began to see race car drivers and soccer players and other people starting to endorse Viagra. But it was a long way from Bob Dole and his wife.
Who'd you expect? Bob Dole?
Viagra, it can give you an erection. Brilliant. It does its job, but it is a sticking plaster. It's plastering over perhaps deeper issues. It doesn't do anything to help people talk properly, openly about sex, especially men. Is it just becomes this, oh, you've got a problem with erectile dysfunction, have a pill. Have a pill, go away.
Women also told me that they felt a sense of guilt if they perceived themselves as not being able to keep up with their husband's renewed libido.
The thing that's missing from almost all the narratives around Viagra is the voices of the women whose partner came back with a blue pill in their pocket.
It's just a mishmash of politics and science and sex and money, 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 money.
It's just part of this constantly neglecting women's sexuality and women's bodies, because it's not treated in the same way. Viagra was this huge investment, and it cost billions, and there's so much money that's sunk into researching erections and penises and libidos and male bodies, and it absolutely dwarfs the research that goes into women's sexuality.
2003, Viagra nets almost $2 billion worldwide.
I'm Dorothy Wetzel, and I was the vice president of consumer marketing at Pfizer for about 10 years. I could think of myself as a below-the-belt marketer. Contraceptives, lubricants, anything you can imagine. Before 2002, Viagra had 100% market share. But then 2002, 2003, we had two competitors, Levitra and Cialis, and market share went from 100% to 75%. That was worrying because you never had competition before. Of course, Pfizer probably felt like, well, we've got the best product, so maybe it won't hurt us as much. And then Cialis came out with a 36-hour claim.
The new yellow pill claims to work faster and last longer than Viagra.
And we started to see market share drop more than we had expected.
The rivalry is so intense, Glaxo put this Levitra ad right outside Pfizer's New York headquarters. Which makes you wonder, is Pfizer feeling a little defensive?
Our management was very concerned. In 2004, my team was asked to take charge of a new Viagra campaign. How do you talk about Viagra in the context of, you know, we all want a good, joyous sex life without making it too tawdry or salacious? We did basic research talking to hundreds of men. And what we discovered was it was kind of complex. While men, older men, desired, oh, I wish I had the sexual functionality that I had when I was young, but, you know, I'm not looking to be this wild and crazy person going off, you know, leaving my wife. I'm very happy where I've arrived in life, but gee, I kind of wish I had that fun side of myself before the mortgage, the kids, the job. So we came up with the idea of, you know, men who desire the, you know, the power of their youth, but the satisfaction of their maturity. But we knew it was really a little edgy, and I thought, well, you know, what's the average person gonna think about this? Are they gonna think it's edgy? And I thought, well, who's in touch with the average person? My minister. It's just a beautiful church. I always notice something different every time I look. You know, I noticed those flowers over there, like about a couple Sundays ago. And I love this window too. It's unusual to talk about sex with your minister, and I was a little uneasy because he was a very formal-looking minister, but I decided I'll just give it a try. What could happen? You know, what could happen?
Remember that guy who used to be called Wild Thing?
The guy who wanted to spend the entire honeymoon indoors?
And so he gave me the great advice of, you know, just make sure that when he's looking at her lovingly and not leeringly.
He's back.
Ask your doctor if Viagra is right for you.
Gosh, I haven't seen that in so long. Oh, God, I don't know, 20 years almost. I'm really proud of it still. It holds up.
A classic Viagra TV ad. Art Kaplan.
The next thing that pops up, and I'm not at Pfizer anymore, but I'm watching the ads in TV, is we get devils appearing, little horns, and sort of saying, you know, Viagra, you kind of can get into some mischief with this drug and maybe have a good time. And I was mad about that because I felt betrayed. Now, in honesty, it didn't say go outside your marriage or show up at prostitutes or something, but it was a long way from the conservative stance that we started with.
I think, you know, a company moves where its audience and its customers are moving. So over time, as society got more comfortable with people talking about erectile dysfunction, people talking about the importance of a sex life, obviously Viagra would change with the times.
You watch Scary Movie 4?
Nope. I haven't watched Scary Movie 1, 2 or 3 either.
Pete Ellis watches a clip from the film Scary Movie 4. In the scene, a young man opens a bottle of Viagra tablets and swallows the contents. He then looks at the label in horror and drops the bottle as he gets a giant erection.
Burst out. The harder you try, the harder it all gets.
The man swallows hundreds of tablets, gets an immediate erection, which he wouldn't. He'd have to be sexually aroused. He was contemplating suicide, so it wouldn't happen. And his penis has grown to disproportionate sizes that, of course, would never happen. There's a maximum limit, and once it's at the maximum, it doesn't get any bigger. But it becomes part of that popular culture. It's kind of a standing joke. I think it's something you have to laugh at it, you have to embrace it. It is what life is. It's a form of free advertising, what the heck? It's what it's become.
2020, Pfizer's Viagra patent expires. Generic versions go on sale.
Even in the beginning, there was a whole conversation about this is a lifestyle medicine. People were concerned that we were like humans obsessed with the fountain of youth. We can't accept aging. There's going to be all kinds of people who will use this medicine in different ways, right? Our goal was really just to enable men to have whatever normal sex means to them in a healthy way.
Somewhere in the USA, a bearded man in his 20s, Cricket, he's wearing a baseball cap backwards.
So, my name's Cricket. I'm 29. Been through a lot of stuff. Definitely here because of my role with the black market diversion of Viagra, amongst other things. Let's call it exotic pharmacy. Strippers can be exotic dancers. I could be an exotic pharmacist. The vast majority of people that I ended up dealing with Viagra, whether it's acquiring it or whatever, they were mid-20s, late-20s. Surprisingly, the most people that I actually had inquire about it were the same people I'm going to raves and festivals with. It's a weird thing, like it's a medicine that's used for its purpose, but sold on the black market the same way illicit drugs are.
There's a lot of guys who take Viagra recreationally. For example, to counteract the effects of Pilly Willy or Whiskey Dick, or to give themselves a bit of a confidence insurance policy.
Take too much Molly, too much ketamine, too much coke, too much heroin, whatever. Your dick's not gonna work, but that doesn't mean you don't want to have sex. I mean, shit.
So a lot of people say that Viagra has morphed into a lifestyle drug. And without question, there's a significant subset of folks that use Viagra as a lifestyle drug. But the world has changed, especially for young men. And it's global.
Occasionally I've been offered it.
I don't want it.
It's usually a guy on a bike that goes around and goes, yeah, Coke, MDMA, speed.
Viagra at the end always.
Normally, when you buy drugs, they buy Viagra, so it's come in the packet together. It's just like part of the party.
At like the peak of my 20s, like the peak of my youth, like constantly going out to bars, clubs. Viagra was kind of like my little secret. If I was going home with somebody, I most likely was going to use one of the Viagra.
The mixture of Viagra with ecstasy is really what they're calling sextasy, and there are real health risks associated with that. Cardiac risk, brain damage, and if not permanent damage to the penis, if you will.
They're not using their judgment, and they can engage in risky sexual behavior, which is why many think that in the larger cities we're seeing a rise in HIV and STDs, herpes, gonorrhea.
Well, the problem is that it's so easy to get Viagra now off the internet and everywhere else.
As a performance-enhancing drug, I find that a little bit troublesome. But also, this world is so completely different. I mean, I think the equation of how sex takes place today is very, very different with the ubiquity of pornography.
The typical young man today, he has access to video games, he has access to social media, he has access to online porn. Every data that you look at is very clear and compelling that people are having less sex. Younger people are having way less sex than before. And the trend lines are not encouraging. In case no one's been paying attention, life is stressful for a lot of people.
To Cricket.
Did you ever feel that you'd become addicted to use of Viagra, maybe?
Viagra itself wasn't addicting, but it compounded into an addicting situation. Like, as a human, you want to have an enjoyable time, and having it on me and going out was 9 times out of 10 a better night than not having it. Like, it's, I don't want to say you get addicted to it, but you do. You get addicted to that feeling of relief, I guess. You get addicted to feeling good, and, you know, feeling confident feels good.
Art Kaplan.
So today, I think most young men learn about sex through pornography online. That's what they see. They have expectations about what good sex is, which may involve more of an erection and less of an emotion. So I worry about how the pill, in a sense, has become part of this, let's call it male-dominated, particular view of what good sexuality is for males. A lot of the ideas we have about sex now come from an industry that is oriented towards sales to men.
It's a story about male dominance in different ways. So the idea of having an erection is this idea of dominance and power, but it's also a discourse around how male sexuality has dominated what we think of as sex.
So the first time I took Viagra, I was actually quite young. I was maybe 18, 19, and it was prescribed to me because I had such anxiety sleeping with people, and I wasn't able to get hard. I was super in my head. But that was the first time I tried it. It was a prescription. And interestingly, it actually didn't work that well, because at that time I had such anxiety that like Viagra wasn't able to even help it. Then over time I started using it again recreationally, and then moving to New York, I found this scene, I found this group, I found these people. So like I'm at a point in my life where I'm going to sex parties where people are bisexual and polyamorous. I'm no longer this one crazy dude who has this lifestyle. To say Viagra is the lifeblood of the city, like, I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Sex columnist Zachary Zane. A snowy Connecticut landscape. Art Kaplan.
I still have ambivalence to this day about the role I played with this drug. Sometimes I even think now it's being sold to people who just as a confidence booster, when somebody tells me they always carry a pill around in their wallet. That wasn't quite the image I had of how Viagra was going to be used or any of these erectile dysfunction drugs. Once I left, a lot of the people who had been working on the drug with me left. They retired. They made a lot of money and handed the drugs management off to other people who weren't there in the early days and hadn't even been around. Those people I didn't know, but I didn't realize that there wouldn't be a kind of corporate memory. Now, subsequently, they expanded the market even more. Some people have said, look, what that company did through marketing was take a small problem and turn it into a major problem. It's starting to make sex a matter of business and profit.
The marketing of drugs in the United States really became a wild, wild west where all sorts of unethical behavior was allowed and became commonplace. This is one of the complaints that was made against Pfizer for its marketing of Viagra and 12 other drugs.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Pirelli. I'm the Associate Attorney General. I'm honored to stand here today with dedicated colleagues from within the Department of Justice as well as beyond it to announce a historic settlement with Pfizer Incorporated.
The investigation of Pfizer began in 2003 with a whistleblower.
So how does a complaint like this arise? You have people within Pfizer saying, we're being pushed to do illegal things. And they're all saying the same story. Pfizer was giving us rewards to do off-label marketing, to even expand beyond this market of erectile dysfunction, even somehow build it beyond the 52%.
So if you want to really focus on the way the pharmaceutical industry has to recoup profits at such an accelerated pace, one of the biggest issues is, you got a limited time. You have a very short patented life that you have to make back whatever you've invested. And that's, in most cases, 17 years fully, which means you might get 10 years on the market, 15 if you're lucky.
I'll just give you a quick rundown of what they found in terms of the type of corruption that was going on. First of all, there was the offering of bribes, kickbacks in cash, entertainment, trips, expensive meals at fine restaurants with spouses, paying doctors $1,000 or more to talk in advance, free tickets to Broadway shows, baseball games, ocean fishing, hunting, golf days with receptions. So what they're doing is they're pouring money and gifts and vacations at both the speakers, but also prescribing doctors. And in this way, there is now a financial incentive for people to not just prescribe, but to be big prescribers, because the more you prescribe, the more you get the free trips and all.
Pfizer has agreed to pay $2.3 billion, the largest healthcare fraud settlement in the history of the Department of Justice.
Which seems like a lot of money, the largest penalty ever imposed on a drug company. But from a financial point of view, it makes sense, because I think Viagra, from the time it was launched in 1998, I think Pfizer got something like $35 billion in global sales during that time. So what do you see even when the people pay fines, corporations pay fines? It's just a business expense.
I think the pharma industry is in a really poor job of marketing themselves. And frankly, they should probably give me a couple $100 million and we could probably help figure it out. Because it's probably one of the worst marketing jobs I've ever seen. The facts of the matter are, the pharmaceutical industry is without question the most important industry on the planet. Because it's the only industry that's dedicated to one thing and one thing only. And that is improving the lives of individuals, period, point blank.
So the largest story is a story really of a corporate or a commercial marketing of drugs. We could take this prescription drug and make it a lifestyle drug. And that's what happened here. That's how it was marketed. We live in the United States of America, which is, medicine is a for-profit enterprise.
At sunset, a ferry sails past the New York City lights.
I remember one day I had this moment of self-doubt. Am I doing the right thing? Am I just making Pfizer a boatload of money? And I came to the conclusion, I hope it's not self-delusional, that it is the right thing to do. It wasn't just about erections. It was about helping couples who had not been able to have intimate relationships regain that part of their life.
Can you see where it says at some point my name and what I do for a living? It says the word sexual medicine. Do you know how many hospital IDs in the United States of America say sexual medicine? This is it. I don't do this because Pfizer created Viagra. I do this because Pfizer's work has helped us help these patients. We will work with whoever helps us do the get the job done to help people.
Viagra was really a second sexual revolution. If you think the pill was a tremendous change for women, and Viagra gave men the ability to enjoy sex into their later years, it probably touched upon their Peter Pan fantasy of remaining young forever.
Do your partners use Viagra? Do they tell you that they use Viagra?
They don't use Viagra.
Really?
Really.
Hair flip. Is that a point of pride?
It's nice at home. My primary partner right now is 10 years older than me. You know, he's going to be 50 before too long. When they get older, assuming we're still together, I assume my partner will want to use Viagra at home. But I wish that he would at sex parties, because he doesn't. Because like so many straight men, they don't understand that the only people getting hard and boning is because they take medicine for it.
In sex club spaces, in my mind, it's less stigmatized, right? Yeah. But still.
But I think it's less stigmatized because you know, because you're a sex journalist, you're a bisexual poly, you're all of the things.
Yeah,
you're
I'm all the things, and I still think straight men struggle more with it than queer men, just because queer men are, I think, just more open, but also it's
so
like...
So are queer women.
So are queer women.
I've taken Viagra.
What was that experience?
So at the time, I was seeing someone who was a professional roadie. So I popped, I think, the maximum dosage of Viagra, you know, instead of like, let's start with the minimum, see what happens.
Fuck that.
I'm like, let's take as much as possible, and if I'm too horny, we'll dial it down.
Were you horny?
Yes, on the train, I was horny.
Like, so it worked.
I was turned on, but, by the time I got to his place, I didn't feel good. And I spent the entire weekend throwing up. And we didn't have sex at all.
Yeah, I think we should encourage more men and people with penises taking it. So what do you think the next generation of Viagra is going to look like? Like enhanced or something.
I'm not a doctor. I don't know about combining drugs with something safe for your heart that gets your dick hard but also helps you emotionally connect with your partner.
Something that is not just physiological.
Exactly.
So something that's not just your dick getting hard.
That
it's something
also
that
helps you like relax and connect and open up and
bond and how that would look.
The Statue of Liberty after dark. Rooney Nelson.
So if you really want to know where we're going to go next, think about it. Imagine supercharging it. Imagine Viagra that not only allows you to have sex, but it's truly mind-blowing sex. Sex is already here on the pantheon of things that humans can do that are amazing. Imagine if that upper limit is moved from here to there. If you're the guy or the girl, you have that pill, and you have it with a partner, that partner is what now? Addicted to you forever. It's the ultimate win. It's the crack cocaine of sex. And that is where I think the future of sex lies. And then the question becomes, what will people pay for that? And the answer is, they'll pay whatever you want.
The American pharma industry is the largest in the world. Today, it's worth an estimated $685 billion.
Simple ways to improve your health and well-being. Just One Thing with Michael Mosley looks at cold therapy. Listen now on BBC Sounds.